Hello and welcome to episode 28 of Chips of Chorlton. My name's Neil Wright. I am joined by Andrew Proudfoot.
Hello, Neil.
And Duncan Wallace.
Still not counting.
And this is sort of part two of our Northeast travels. The second part, we had the privilege to interview Paul Smith.
We did.
With an extreme hangover.
I haven't seen a hangover like it.
No.
Yeah. It possibly didn't exist. We might have still been drunk. I don't think we've been that hungover on band business since our trip to the US Embassy. And let me tell you, I mean, machine guns or no machine guns.
Yeah.
The fear.
Yeah, the fear is real, people.
So I think we should probably explain a little bit about how the night out went after the Frankie interview.
Yeah, so we went back to the hotel, checked in.
Family room, triple room, travel lodge, sorted.
Which, you know, and I think that's a very professional decision for us to do that. Because we did walk past the Spoons, the One Spoons, in Sunderland, which we've always kind of mothed to a flamed towards. We even walked past it and thought, no, we'll be sensible. Yep. Bags first.
Yes.
And then it all went south very quickly.
Well, I mean, we went to Beast from Hide and Beast, Neil. His Mexican restaurant immediately after we left the hotel for some delightful Mexican food.
Yeah.
And I think at that point we were thinking, because obviously all the Frankie lads, they've got kids and responsibilities and they maybe couldn't come out. So I was thinking, maybe it's just going to be a bit of a quiet one. We'll have a couple here and then off to Barry's pub and then that might be it.
Little did you know, however, I had been on the Facebook messengers with a one Ian Black.
Ian Black.
Of Label Mates Slug fame.
Oh, what a legend.
Yeah. He's not afraid of a shipyard.
No,
or a few.
He had a few.
So we got him out for some very intense kind of writer's workshop conversations, actually. I came out of that inspired. It was, it was Professor Black territory.
He was great.
Which is sadly not the character from Cluedo.
It's a shame.
It's Dr. Black that's the murder victim, isn't it?
Why am I talking
about Cluedo?
it's a real shame we didn't get his take on a concept album writing a character piece on how much of a shit you are. Not you, Duncan, but, you...
Exactly. Yeah. Thank you, Andy.
You was the eye.
You have no idea how long I've been waiting to hear that, especially from your mouth. It felt as if we'd missed out on a golden opportunity for a golden episode. It could have been a bit of a writer's workshop, that one.
Yeah, but a personal assassination album, I quite like. Yeah.
We missed out a wicked chip review as well. Mexico 70s food was sublime.
We're not just saying that because we know
the owner very well, and he's a very nice man.
Very nice man, and he invited us back to his place and just pumped us full of margarita.
In true Sunderland style, he literally grabbed us from a pub across the road, like commandeered us back to his place and gave us some margaritas. The hospitality is it's Premier League.
It really was. So we woke up on Sunday morning. I think I woke up again. I'm used to probably getting up earlier due to my two children, and I woke you both up and said, "Lads,
what happened was I had my, as a man in his early 30s gets, I had my my timely rise for a toilet trip. Yeah,
of course.
Just to clarify, bloody hell. And even just to clarify even further, I'm talking about a onesie here.
I've never heard it be referred to as timely rise.
And then I walked out the toilet to see both of you looking at me like... spooning lovers, but you weren't in the same bed.
You
were both, but from the angle, you were just both staring at me. It's like, well, I guess we're up then. Yeah. And it's like, do we have to be up? We still don't know how much we paid for that bottle of wine on the way home.
Oh, God.
Yeah, that bottle of wine. Yeah. Wine from a mug.
I don't know why.
All that.
I have a very, very hazy recollection
of going in there. We were so excited to watch the politics, weren't we? do you remember, Andy? We were going to watch the politics at about 1 a.m.
Oh, my God. I do not remember that.
With the Chardonnay. Do you remember what wine we bought in the end? I remember you being quite snobby about it.
Yeah, I think I was. And no, I don't remember. I had one sip of it and then threw the mug of wine down the drain.
Yeah.
But I'd walked into that bar and said, like... in my best sober voice, "Hello, kind barkeep. will you sell us, perchance, a bottle for the road?
Of your finest like, white
yeah,
grape.
No worries, mate.
White grape drink."
Then you put the fear in my mind. The next day, he said, do you have any idea what you paid for that? Like a sort of takeout price. Like, no, I don't. He could have charged us 500 quid.
Yeah, he could have played it real cool hand yeah. Luke on that.
Yeah, it was great. And then, so we went for breakfast at the Wetherspoons.
We did go to the Spoons in the end, which was a fun little game of breakfast jigsaw, wasn't it? No one quite got what they ordered.
No.
In the correct order.
It was
But
weird.
We all got there in the end.
I ordered all the drinks and didn't drink them because I didn't know what I wanted. It was
You
weird.
Were so jealous of Andy's dark fruits. Oh. Andy was on the dark fruits before 10 a.m. He was in full stag do yep. top gear mode.
Has to be done.
And then, yeah, because I had to drive, didn't I? I had to drive us to Newcastle.
Indeed.
Where we went to the Clooney.
That was a tough drive, wasn't it?
It was for me.
Especially after we got lost in that Chinese supermarket on the way.
Duncan was like, he said, "I need a bottle of water." Oh, there's a Chinese supermarket.
What it was just literally like, the nearest shop, and it was like, and it was a corner shop, but it was like, well, where's the water?
There was like a lot. I thought you went in there and, to get some sort of like.
They had an Argos catalogue's worth of Chinese waters. I was Evian. There we go. Right. Okay, I know this one.
Doing, yeah. So we got to the Clooney.
Yeah.
To interview Paul Smith.
Yes.
I was a bit starstruck. I felt like Maximum Park.
You lame-o.
I was so lame. I was so hungover and so lame. Maximum Park, really game-changing for me, sort of mid-2000s. What's your relationship with their music and with Paul Smith from Dutch Uncles?
So we were very early on Dutch Uncles.
It was our college band moniker.
What, when we supported them?
Oh, no. We were Dutch Uncles when we supported them.
Yeah.
First time.
Yeah, because I didn't want to go into the original time that I'd met him, because it's in the interview that we'll hear in a bit. But the first time we met him properly in a professional sense, I guess, we supported them at the Apollo. We never really discovered the origins of that, but I think by talking to him, and as the listeners will hear later...
Well, that's how the gig came around.
Yeah, he is a prolific music listener, so yes. I wouldn't be surprised if it was perhaps a recommendation from someone else, or he'd just heard of us and liked what he heard, I suppose. So we ended up
The system worked, which yeah. again is another reference well, to yeah. the interview.
But yeah, we ended up supporting them at Manchester Apollo, which at the time was the biggest gig we'd done.
Oh, it was
by
huge.
Far.
Yeah. It was huge. I've never been so close to being sick before going on stage, I don't think.
Yeah.
I remember I drove you to that gig and it was just little things like, oh, there's a canteen underneath and help
Incredible.
Yourself. And we're like, really?
Yeah.
This is unreal, wasn't it?
It's amazing. It's amazing the passiveness you get to that sort of stuff later on.
For what you've just said there, fast forward to 7 years on the Garbage Tour.
Oh,
and
man.
Every night it's like, my God, if that catering has another fucking Sunday roast on their menu, I swear I'm going to scream. It's like, how many Sunday roasts did we have in the space of a week?
You're exactly right.
It's literally the only thing on the menu every time. It's like, another roast.
And every night I had dessert. Why?
It's like, we're on stage in 15 minutes.
Just because it's in front of me.
Just
like,
don't have
everything.
The potatoes. If you don't want them, don't have them.
So, it's just like, yeah, well, yeah.
Good God, yeah.
But, and it was extraordinary. And I don't know, the Apollo's an extraordinary venue as well, because I think it's a place that's just wrapped in romance for us.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, the first place.
Oh, definitely. It's a band's venue as well. So naturally, yeah. we saw some of our first gigs there. Yeah.
And then the first time you get your dressing room in there and you go, is it all this shade of red? Like everything, like yeah. the carpets, the walls, yeah. the ceiling. It's like yeah. something out of Clockwork Orange,
yeah.
but not in the way that sounds great.
So, but I'm trying to think of our relationship after that gig with them at the Apollo.
Yeah, what happened was, after that gig, because I remember, I don't know if we mentioned it in the interview or not, but he completely nailed down exactly what point of King Crimson's career we were ripping off.
Ah, yes, that's right.
And I do look back on that gig we did with them at the Apollo and just go, that's what bands with certainty do. They play wacky as F wording B-sides as possible. Like, if you look back on the set list we played for that gig, you'd think, what the hell were we thinking?
Mm.
Also, I remember dedicating a song to my brother because it was on his birthday and he hadn't shown up.
Oh, God.
Just one empty seat at the back.
You empty-seated him.
I found out, yeah, no, he empty-seated me. I empty-seated myself. I should get into politics. But then after that, every time we played in Newcastle, except for all those Sunderland trips that we mentioned previous, Paul was always present. He'd always be there. He'd always show up. He'd always have something really constructive, really insightful to say. Not that you just want to talk about yourselves, but he would always, he'd always be very engaging.
Yep. I think this was off mic, I think. Or was it? Did I say it? When we were side stage Apollo and he... we were all obviously incredibly nervous, and he'd given us a bit of a pep talk. And I think this was at the point where we were wondering whether we should play the most Crimson Discipline era song possible. And he was like, "Yeah, you should definitely do it. Why not?" You know.
So yeah, coming up in this interview again, much like the penciled in plan we had with the Frankie interview. Once again, we were met with a ridiculous circumstance. We showed up to the Clooney at midday. The Clooney, great venue, of course. We should give them a great shout out. The work they do is solid, superior stuff.
Yeah.
So we thought, right, well, yeah, it's going to be a quiet room. We're just going to sit down. This is where it's going to be. We couldn't be more wrong about that. There was a sold-out gig occurring at 1 p.m., a matinee show by a band called The Spitfires, who, from what I could tell, did, swinging covers.
Did they?
Or swing covers. No, certainly not swinging covers.
It's about swinging.
Yeah, certainly not swinging covers. Swing covers. I think something like that was going on. I thought I could hear the Red Dwarf theme tune getting blasted out at one point. Which has nothing to do with swing. But there was a lot of old men in paisley shirts kind of action going on, wasn't there?
Yeah,
a lot of that going on, and once again, it made it very hard to actually hear what Paul was saying.
And this is going to be of real interest to sort of general music lovers of all genres as well, because he speaks so passionately about music, and as we'll hear in the interview, but he listens to a lot of it.
But there was a penciled out plan to discuss German touring life, because something we have something in common with. We didn't really get a chance to say much about it other than Paul, of course. And there was also trying to talk about the importance of literature on his lyricism. I really wanted to get that in, but there just wasn't time, I don't think. Unfortunately, in the end. But we did talk about the Blue Nile for 15 minutes, so I'll take that.
Oh, that was amazing. That felt like the sort of completely apex of my hangover.
Completely uncued as well. He just went off on that. I was like, wow. I got to sit down.
Yeah, I mean, it was all great, but there was a lovely connection about that.
Okay, so here it is. Maybe our last podcast of the year? Maybe.
Nah, we'll get one more in.
We'll squeeze one more in.
Just the boys. Back in the den.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay. If you can get the bloody heating on.
So here we go, our interview at the Clooney with Paul Smith.
Which we're saving.
Yeah. I'm recording now.
Thanks, Paul.
So thanks. You brought a record. This is our podcast first.
Yeah.
Podcast first for us. Someone's actually given us something.
The only thing that people have given us before is potatoes.
We've got Mike Jones's potatoes. And now we've got Paul Smith's
Lovely. Thanks, Paul.
No worries.
Wonderful.
No worries.
I thought it'd be polite.
Yeah. No, thanks. So we are here at the Clooney. Surprisingly busy Clooney.
It's midday on a Sunday, and it is rammed in here.
That's Newcastle for you. they just can't stop.
The band playing next door, they're called the Spitfires. I'm really intrigued to know what they sound like, because there's a lot of middle-aged men in paisley shirts around.
You're about to find out, because the walls are not as thick as we would like them to be.
So. Well, exactly. I mean, I was asking the bar staff, is it an amplified or acoustic gig? She's like, I don't know. It's like, okay.
Well, yeah.
Because we're trying to do a podcast here, love.
I'm going for very definitely moddy. Yeah. We'll find out.
Yeah, I think.
So how are you doing, Paul? You just spoke sort of off mic. You've just been to Germany.
I have, yes.
Haven't you? How was that? Was that all right?
It was really good, really good. I managed to sandwich a solo tour in between two Max Seymour Park shows, because we were playing... The band were playing Rolling Stone Festival. Rolling Stone magazine, well known in America, is also massive. It has its own kind of thing in Germany. Which, when I first started touring, I was really surprised to find.
Interesting.
Having known nothing about rock journalism in Germany. So anyway, Rolling Stone had put on this show in the south of Germany in a theme park that is closed for the winter, which was a fairly unusual experience.
Wow. Yeah.
And then up in an old sort of, I think it would have probably been Eastern Germany, maybe. An old sort of camp, like a chalet sort of place where people would go on their holidays and, you know, get the towels down on the the freezing cold beach at the Baltic, looking out onto the Baltic Sea.
Wow.
But yeah, we played two shows. Specials as well were playing, and
nice.
The guitarist Linval from the Specials wandered into our dressing room and didn't know who we were, but just had a really nice chat with him.
Yeah,
and then
then
we saw him the next week, because these two shows were 1 week apart, which is usually in this country, obviously you got your Reading and Leeds or whatever, and
right.
you flip flop, and one you go overnight on your tour bus or set off the next day, and you do the same lineup plays two consecutive nights, but this was 1 week apart, which is logistically a little bit annoying.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
but yeah. for me, who I had a solo record out a year ago and hadn't managed to play in Germany yet, and had kind of put it on the back burner with lots of other different things, and couldn't really afford to do it particularly. Mm. It gave me the opportunity to sort of nick two members of Maximo Park, Tom,
nice.
Our drummer, and our new keyboard player Gemma, because our keyboard player Lucas has emigrated and started a new life in Australia with his wife and a new baby. We've got Gemma in, and Gemma's great at synth bass as well. She's in loads of different... she's called Gemma Freeze, and she's in the Freeze Trio. She's based in Leeds, and she's in this band Jay Frisco, a jazz musician, really. And we're actually Maximo Parker firing on all cylinders now.
Yeah,
no disparagement to Lucas.
Yeah.
That sounded really bad now. But for somebody to come into the band at this stage in the game, you know, we're sort of 15 years old as a band or whatever.
Yeah.
And she slotted in really nicely, and she came and played bass for me, and we used the same van that Maximo Park had driven our gear over to Germany with.
Yeah.
And so, it allowed me to go on this little tour of sort of 150 capacity venues.
Amazing.
And play my solo stuff. And the first night, I will be honest, when the toilet door didn't lock in a grotty...
I've just had a similar experience.
Wherever you go, in any small venue, there will always be some problems.
You'll always be putting your foot on the door.
Yeah. bum on the door if it's a small cubicle.
Yeah.
lots of different scenarios. So I started the tour in a place where the door didn't lock, and I thought, why am I doing this? The stuff on the rider was not there. Because we have cereal, and we eat it on the road the next
really?
Day.
Well,
we have milk and cereal on the rider.
Any specific cereal?
Some sort of muesli.
Yes. Okay.
In Germany, they have a lot of chocolate. They have choco muesli, which is...
It's quite indulgent for
breakfast
time.
It's tasty, but it's not, it's not going to do you any good after a week of that.
Yeah.
So we have some sort of... I did some research and put it on the rider, the exact brand that I wanted. That's the kind of guy I am.
Yeah.
I was tour managing I was tour managing myself. Tom was driving. Just three of us in a three-seater van with all the gear in the back, driving around the autobahns.
Oh.
And
Playing autobahn.
That's exactly what we did.
As soon as the iPod gets plugged in, I said, "Guys, indulge me.
We gotta do this."
It feels like a cliche. You sort of feel dirty doing it, but it's like autobahn
it is so good,
especially in the winter as well. I think it's even more special.
And I just listened to, I think it was on Late Junction on Radio 3 at night. I'd listened to a program about. A woman whose father had invented lots of artificial vocals for dolls, I think it was, in the 40s or something like that, and went into the idea of the voice kind of haunting the future, past voices. I'm getting a bit deep into this already. But one of these dolls that had been left to kind of decay, that you could press it or whatever, and it said 1, 2 or whatever, or some sort of primitive synthesizer. I can't remember which one. It went through the whole range of all of these artificial voices, and Kraftwerk went on tour in America, had found one of these dolls, and that's what they use as their artificial voice
when they talk to the crowds.
So that when they sit on the Numbers song, it's like Eins. Obviously, they have them in different languages.
Mm.
And so, they picked up some of these primitive synthesized voices, vocoders or whatever you, I don't know what you, yeah. I'm not a technical man, but I'd listen to that. And first song on the Autobahn was Autobahn, and I could tell everybody my little story about weird dolls that sort of malfunction and end up sounding pretty weird and horrible.
Talking about useless, well, not useless, but strange technology, we were going to ask you, actually, we saw Maximo Park play an in-store show at Piccadilly Records, probably... I want to say 15 years ago. No, probably not. Maybe 12.
I think it was maybe early 2005.
It must have been pre-album, but
it would have been one of the singles was coming out. I think Graffiti or Going Missing or something like that.
I think maybe you... Oh, I can't remember where you were playing. Oh, no, you played the Dry Bar. Was that the same
thing? Yeah, we played it.
Yes.
I remember
we were
that
there as well.
At the time
when we met you, obviously, to get the single signed.
Obviously.
And I don't know if you, I don't know if you remember, but we gave you... a demo CD, but it was in the shape of a business card.
Yeah, it was a wallet-friendly demo. and you were
slot nicely into your wallet and listen to you later.
You were absolutely enamored with it. I remember you were like, "Wow, that's canny. Like, what is that?"
I must have it somewhere.
But I think it only works in those CD players where you have to sort of slot it in, where the sort of spike goes through the middle of it.
Right.
I think anything else, you can't just slot it into a CD player. I don't think
you still got it, right?
This must be in. I have a pile of CDs that I have never listened to. I'll level with you. As Alan Partridge once said, I'll level with you. I'm scared. I have a pile of CDs that I always intended to listen to, and I couldn't throw them out because people had spent so much time. Mm. And I'm the sort of person who buys probably 3, maybe 4 records a week.
Yeah,
I've got a problem. You know, I haven't been on holiday in years now. I've got an addiction, but I still have, once a year I'll try and get through a pile of demos or things that people have given to me.
I mean, this could have been thrown away as mistaken for a receipt.
I think you have to have a policy on it. I think you have to kind of say to yourselves as a band or as a touring unit, if people give you demos, you've got to listen to it the next morning, otherwise you're just never going to get around to doing
true.
It. You've got to be like, I will listen to this in the next 12 hours, you may find out what I think.
Yeah.
It's true, because then you end up disassociating the names from the faces and all of that kind of thing. And somebody once gave me a business card, actually. I think it was in America, and they knew that I was a big fan of American Psycho, both the book and the movie.
Mm.
And my not stage persona as such, but you know, there was a small nod to the idea of wearing a suit on stage and throwing yourself around and being sort of the inner turmoil of somebody who's going through their everyday life, struggling to escape the boundaries of their workwear.
Yeah.
That was kind of...
Yeah.
You know, there's lots of other things that I was thinking about. I was thinking about Brian Ferry and thinking about all sorts of things. Brian Ferry on a very, very low budget. But somebody knew that I liked American Psycho, and they gave me a business card saying, with Patrick Bateman, the main character in American Psycho's details on, and... I can't even remember now. I haven't read it in a long time. Yeah. Is it Pearson he works for, whatever. Yeah. And it's in the same sort of fine bone.
It's embossed on bone.
Yeah,
did someone go to the trouble of making it like a high quality?
It's debossed.
Yeah. Oh, lovely.
And somebody gave it to me like on tour and said, "Hey, here's my card," or whatever. And I was thinking,
just
this
sweating,
is,
looking at
yeah,
it.
Yeah, pretty weird.
But did it have a? Was it a CD as well, Paul?
It wasn't a CD as well. So I'm surprised that it's not ringing more bells than it did. But it was a big day. For me, that day, there was lots of things going on in my life.
Exactly, yeah.
At that time, and things did slip through the net in the van that we were trying to creep around the UK in. On a low budget. I think we got robbed on that tour. Somebody broke into our van in Birmingham nicked. And maybe
your CD.
That's clearly where it's gone.
This revolutionary technology.
They left my typewriter. The next day, we went and had a look, and we were like, "Oh my god!" And certain things had gone missing. if you'll pardon the pun, it's not the song is not called Gone Missing, even though people say that to me a lot. Anyway, Our Velocity is not called My Velocity. I get that a lot. I love that song, My Velocity. And you go, all right, okay.
Does anyone ever call you the Maximo Park?
somebody, I think it may have been in Japan, said, or no, it might have been Germany, said, so which one is Maximo? That has happened. In Japan, actually, somebody came, maybe three or four times out of 6 million interviews that I did, somebody said, so is Paul Smith your real name? And I was thinking, if I was going to pick a pseudonym or whatever, you know, I would probably not pick this particular name that is quite, you know... it's a very, very well-known name in our country.
Yeah.
And they thought I'd kind of named myself after the clothes designer to be a quintessential English band. Because at that time as well, a lot of the bands that were doing well and were in the charts, sort of, they were saying it was the new Britpop.
Mm, yeah.
Especially when you were abroad. In this country, they had other names for it, mostly disparaging, which is... fairly true as well. Yeah, there was a lot of bad bands around at that time.
Yeah.
But yeah, you know, everywhere we went, the new Britpop, and it was like British flags and stuff, which we were very uncomfortable with.
Yeah.
And in Japan, again, they love, you know, it fetishizing the British culture. Mm. And over here, you know,
yeah,
I'm probably one of those people who is, you know, Tokyo, the futuristic Blade Runner city, yes. And, you know, everybody has their own ideas about somewhere that's so far away.
At the time of the revolutionary business card demo. But I mean, that was like an indie... Well, I mean, we grew up in it, really. It was formative years for us. That was the indie revolution. And you were very much a part of that as well, alongside with... like.
Strangely enough, but yeah, it's true.
Yeah,
and
I mean,
these days I look back and I think I've no idea how anything happened or why we were part of it, because we felt so separate from it. Well, I mean, there was when you look again, if you take a step back and you go, okay, you know, we were wearing we were smartly dressed Northerners, you know, there was lots of kind of skinny ties and suits going on.
Yeah,
it wasn't like. You know, I think a lot of people were looking at sort of music that they hadn't grown up with, but that time beforehand, like post-punk music.
Yeah.
But we were often sort of baffled by the post-punk comparisons, because songs like Going Missing or Graffiti were more influenced by American alternative rock that we'd grown up with. And, you know, it's one of those things where you look back now and think there was, you know, a lot of bands... making very conservative kind of music, and we felt like we were trying to put some sort of heart and soul into it for a start, and have articulate lyrics or themes and interesting arrangements and a diverse set of influences. But I think, again, looking at it now, maybe the idea of it being pop and us wanting to be a pop band really helped us fit in some way, even though we felt apart from it was the idea. People often said to me, oh, your songs are so anthemic, and I would think, good, but I also thought, it's strange that like a song called Books from Boxes, which is about unpacking books from boxes, you know, and is more about a kind of sort of emotional melancholy song would be taken to people's hearts over something else that might be a little bit more accessible, or a song called Our Velocity being in, you know, in the top 10
I remember that seems fairly
far out now. But then everything becomes assimilated, and then, you know, we were part of it, and we will always be seen as part of it. And you have to also acknowledge that and go, well, that's great. It's you know, it's allowed us to have a fan base who are not surprised when we take left turns, and they allow us to get on with making pop music from an independently minded alternative left field viewpoint.
Mm. Yeah.
That's a very long answer to your question. I don't even know if you asked the question anymore. Maybe you just intimated something.
Yeah, I mean, I wanted to talk about my formative years in the indie revolution, really.
But yeah, and carry on.
Yeah. No, but yeah, but I mean, yeah, you're such a big part of it. But I was thinking at the time, was it sort of, I mean, to be sort of successful or to gather, you know, sort of acclaim when there were so many other sort of guitar bands around at the time, do you think that was more difficult, or was it easy to just sort of be involved with a scene?
I think it was easier for us because we didn't look or act or have songs quite like anybody else.
Yeah.
And I think...
Well, yeah, it's true.
You know,
yeah,
there are a lot. There aren't that many bands from that time who are still around.
Well, I was going to say, I mean...
That's quite interesting. Yeah.
I mean, ultimately, longevity comes from writing good songs, which I believe you did.
I'm in agreement. although, I don't want to...
And it sounds so basic, but...
Yeah,
it is,
but this is the thing. We I feel like being... I think... You know, being from Newcastle helped us in many ways to be the band that we are.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
we were very much out of the limelight. There's no denying that to begin with. And it allowed us to... I mean, we felt like we had an album with 13 songs that was a timeless record.
Yeah.
And then we were playing those songs up here. We were playing in, you know, most of those songs in other places very sparsely. We played... in Manchester and London, before we were probably as good as we could have been at that point.
Yeah, yeah.
But ultimately, people even up here started to know a little bit more about us once we were signed, once we had a single out,
yeah.
And that's when we started selling out places up here. You know, we'd have a good crowd and we'd sell out the Head of Steam or whatever with our album's worth of stuff that was just, you know, nearly ready.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was even locally, people only took real notice once there was a kind of national interest. And it felt like, oh, well, you know, if somebody had paid attention 7 months ago or whatever, you know, we might have thought, these songs are the best ones, we don't need to write anymore.
Yeah. Mm.
And our first album wouldn't have been as good as I think it is.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
whether it's good or not, it's still better than it would have been sort of 8 months early, because we were only really a band for the band had existed for maybe a year and a half before I joined, and then I think it was maybe 18 months and we got signed.
Yeah.
From me never singing in my life to on Warp Records, alongside again idols of ours like Aphex Twin, Square Pusher.
But you're quite sort of the square peg in the round hole in regards to their roster, aren't you? Like you're the odd one out. It's a dance label, isn't it?
Well, this is the thing. At that time, Warp were trying to do different things, and they'd signed Gravenhurst, who, you know, I absolutely love Gravenhurst, and it was kind of, I suppose, singer-songwriter stuff on its very most basic level, you know, a guy with an acoustic guitar. It's much more than that. But yeah, they were trying to find those oddities from other genres.
Yeah.
I mean, Chick Chick Chick, again, it's very danceable, but it was a band, and, we felt like very much contemporaries of them, trying to do something a little bit different.
Yeah.
And that's being on Warp also helped people go, right, maybe this band is a little bit different from sort of major label subsidiary stuff that's just churning out.
Did you ever experience any kind of like Warp tribalism? Like sort of like real fans of the label? It's like, this isn't electronic dance music. Like,
Where's Maximo?
Yeah. I mean,
which one of you is Maximo so I can beat him up? Should be here.
Yeah, no, we were always aware that there was going to be some sort of backlash because the sound of it is still, you know, guitars and keyboards singing a band, pop songs. There's no getting away from that traditional element of it.
Yeah.
But we were actually welcomed by sort of, you know, I guess it was probably 50-50. Some people would just say, this really isn't my music. And other people go, well, yeah, you know, I was into the Smiths and I was into, Aphex Twin at the same time or whatever. And you guys are that kind of next band along who I really like.
Yeah.
And I probably wouldn't have heard you because I'm more into electronic music. And I've heard you because you're on Warp.
Yeah.
And it meant... especially in somewhere like America, where we were really, you know, it's a very, very vast place. You know, it's very hard to kind of get any attention. Especially, you know, you could be on a radio station that's massive on one side of the country, and it just isn't on the other side. And that's just the way it goes. And so, we'd end up in record shops looking at our record in the electronica section because it was on Warp.
Yeah.
And our early singles were in those sections.
That's crazy,
and
isn't it?
So, in some ways, it kind of it threw people off, and that you know, that was tough for us because we were thinking, oh, you know, if this was in the right section, we'd like to think somebody would pick it up and like it.
Yeah. Yeah.
On the other hand, it gave us that sort of alien aspect that I think suits the nature of the band. You know, we are, if nothing else, kind of idiosyncratic pop music, and I think we were never meant to be wallpaper, you know, and that was always our intention. And again, all the way through to, you know, the album Too Much Information, even titling it Too Much Information, yeah. That's the way that I write lyrics is often very heart on sleeve. And
yeah.
It's, you know, I'm putting it out there. If people like it or not, that is, again, it's a taste thing. And we've always said, you know, this is not for everyone. But hopefully it'll be for people who are quite discerning about their music. You know, if you don't like the sound of sort of electric guitars, however unusual we try and make them on occasion, or if you don't like songs that are 3-minute pop songs with choruses and middle eights and stuff, then you're probably not going to like it. If you know, it's probably not to your taste. But if you have a fondness for that, and you also like, you know, David Sylvian or Robert Wyatt, and then you also think, oh no, this is I like this song. You know, I wouldn't normally like this. That was kind of where we were trying to maybe position ourselves. And after that, things get out of your control, and perceptions are a bit more cast iron, and there's not much you can do about it once that sets in. You know, there will always, if you are well known to some extent, that will harden, and then that will be something that you will struggle to shift. But in those days, signing to Warp made so much sense for us because they said you have complete creative freedom.
Yeah,
and you know you could make a Fugazi record if you want, or you can make a Gary Newman kind of record. It's up to you. We know you can go both ways, or you can go somewhere in the middle, which is where you are.
I think we were talking last night on the Lash with our label. I beg your pardon. We were talking last night with our label mate Ian Black of Slug fame. And I was talking to him about sort of the invisible shackles of complete creative freedom. Because we're a bit like, it's nice being on Memphis, because like, the A&R department of side of it is all very well. You know, you can just write whatever you want, essentially.
Yeah.
And you can only feel bad about how much it costs them to record it. But at the same time, I was a bit like, the hard thing about that is that if you present to them a finished body of work and go, here it is, guys. Like, you didn't ask about any of it, but here it is, fully finished. And then they just come back and go, needs a single. and then you're a bit fucked, really. Because you've created what you consider to be... Yeah. A start, middle, and end, and then all of a sudden you have to accept. Okay, well, I guess it doesn't have any radio appeal. We better find a single and just stick
absolutely.
It in the middle. You know, they can open the second half of the vinyl, whatever.
I suppose like there's sort of creative freedom, but also you need to be constantly reassured about creative freedom. So like with every song, you almost need to check that you're still having creative freedom and that it's. Not shit, I suppose, as well at the same time.
Mm. Yeah, I think for us, we set our stall out as being pop, you know, and that to me can mean a lot of different things. You know, it can mean big star, you know, power pop. It can mean Kraftwerk, you know, the model is, you know, that's like a perfect pop song.
Yeah, it is, definitely.
It could mean anything as long as it's got the hooks and as long as there's something to pull the listener in. And for us, since we set our stall out like that, and we all have very different interests in the band, musical interests, and the kind of one overlap is a love of a finely crafted pop song.
Yeah.
And once you've crafted it, it can go in all those different directions. Whatever happens, that sort of bedrock is there. And that's not to say that's what I think is the... you know, my archetypal ideal for songs. Songs can be anything, but that's the one thing that kind of unites us as a band, so it will always be there, and we will always want to write singles, and we will always want to put as many hooks in as we feel the song can hold.
So that's part of
our sort of raison d'etre as a band. You know, if we got away from that, I feel like we'd be getting too far away, and then it would go in a direction that probably, like, Tom, our drummer, might not like, or, you know... Dunk, our guitarist, might say, I don't feel comfortable with that. That's not what... Or me and Dunk might like it, and Tom would go, no, that's getting far too far away from this. So we're kind of... We're moored and anchored to the idea of creating a pop song and trying to manipulate it in a way that makes it sound fresh and that isn't just regurgitating the past.
So do you think you can appreciate... Well, or do you guys appreciate pop music in its sort of purest sense, major label, you know,
absolutely.
Chart pop. I mean, do you appreciate it the same way that you appreciate, like, say, Kraftwerk, for example? Or
absolutely.
Like
do you appreciate its more vacuous tendencies in the modern era? and kind of like the name checking and all the alcohol referencing that there is now?
You can find me in the club, you know, that kind of thing. I think if you
find you in Pop World, yeah. On the rotating dance floor.
Yeah. Well, this is it. We do have our own. In the club, drinking songs that are fairly sparse in some ways within our catalogue. But again, yeah, that the In Another World song you'd have found yourself by now. That is obviously about a revolving dance floor on the old Tuxedo Royale, in which was a boat that floated. It got moved to Middlesbrough in the end, and they've just scrapped it. Now it's just been sat around near Middlesbrough's football ground. Oh. But it's finally gone. Tuxedo Royale is no more.
Oh.
This is the thing. Those sort of universal themes and the growing up, you can't help but come across that. Even if you were, the Smiths in the 80s talking about how you weren't part of that and you were in opposition to it or being celibate or whatever, or, you know.
Yeah.
The things that people experience and things that people are interested in growing up, those rites of passages will always be fodder for amazing pop songs. And that, you know, I have a fondness for the soft rock that I grew up with. I love George Michael's voice, for example.
Yeah.
I think it's like one of the best instruments that pop music has ever produced.
Well, I mean, it's based around I suppose a lot of pop music is based around excellent voices or characterful voices. A bit like Maxima Park as well. You have a very characterful voice.
We were saying on the way here, actually, your voice has a very almost an 80s pop tendency to it. The way it's unashamedly sticks out. It's very, you know, it's very in your face, kind of like in terms of its pop sensibility.
Oh,
it's something that a lot of bands have tried to, you know. In terms of looking back towards 80s music and saying, well, you know, a bit, like we wanted to be like Tears of Fears when we started, you know,
still
doing the jingles and stuff. Still trying. but it's really hard to not get the backlash from that, because nowadays it is a lot more bedroom pop. But yeah, but congratulations.
Yeah. Oh, thank
congratulations
you.
For making a success of a loud voice.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's a song on our last record called What Equals Love, and that was, to me, it was right. This feels like it could really be one of those sort of 80s pop singles. In the end, the production that we had, we went off to Wilco's studio in Chicago and we recorded it as a band.
Yeah.
And it's us playing live on the whole of that record to some extent. You know, there's a few overdubs, but not many. And that song in particular could have been a lot more sort of polished and hi-fi. And in the end, it still is. Because that's, you know, the arpeggiated keyboard that Lucas had, and there's a little bit more kind of processing on the sonics of that.
Yeah.
But to me, it was like, I want to write a song that is a mixture of a sort of Cyndi Lauper song and, what's it? Never Too Much by Luther Vandross. And that's what I was going for, you know, and I knew that it would sound like me, and that confidence of singing it like you mean it, and that is, you know, writing words and trying to find a melody that suits your voice and stuff, but still having a kind of nod and a belief in that kind of stuff. You know, like, I mean, you can't get a better song than Never Too Much by Luther Vandross. It just isn't possible. And that's, you know, I wouldn't say it's my favorite song of all time, because, you know, I have a million of those, but I would say it's up there. You know, there's nothing better than that, I don't think.
Yeah.
And so for me, to have that in what might be called an indie band is a healthy thing.
Yeah.
You know, indie music has become a kind of beacon of conservatism, and that's distressing to me, because, again, I love a lot of alternative music. There's still, you know, guitar, drums, keyboards, you know, I love strings. I love hearing the, you know, acoustic timbre of an instrument, and it still gives me a thrill to hear an electric guitar.
Yeah.
Again,
yeah.
So a lot of people abuse that and churn out, what, you know, dad rock for ad infinitum, but there is something raw and primal about, you know, attacking your instrument with whatever emotion is in your body and in your mind, and that somehow coming out at the end and trying to find a way of translating your feelings into a pop song. And I guess that's, you know, Like, one of my favourite bands is the Go-Betweens, and you can't really say, well, you know, that this was their crazy techno album or whatever. You know, they didn't change a lot. You know, they matured in terms of, like, a life being lived, you know, lives yeah. being lived, mm. influences seeping into their music.
Yeah.
And that's how I want to develop, because... with especially in the band, I mean, outside of the band, I you know, I assume that I will make quite different records. I hope to, you know, yeah. like the record I made with Peter Brewis, Frozen by Sight, again is one of my the favorite things that I've done, because yeah. it sounds exactly like the record that we set out to make, and yeah. it, and mm. influenced by the things that I wanted it to be influenced by, but yeah. also very much our own record,
yeah.
and the same with Mac Seymour Park, you know. Or my solo stuff, you know, I'm interested in songs, and you try and find that kind of collaborative sweet spot where everybody's really into what you're doing, but it also feels fresh and yeah. exciting to, and hopefully to other people. You know, we try and take a step back, which I think a lot of other bands, certainly bands don't do. They're just like, yeah, this is brilliant, this is us, fantastic, and it just sounds like them again.
Yeah.
So yeah, you know, that's the. To have that 80s pop influence in there is, that's part of what I'm into. You know, like the
yeah.
on our second record, just popped into my head there on the song Russian Literature, there's a line that goes, she won't be saved, and there's like a kind of vocal trill in it, which I was listening to a lot of Sandy Denny at the time, and I was thinking, and Ann Briggs, yeah. folk musicians, and I was thinking, I really want to have that in a song, and that's yeah. where it fits. And yeah. most people would probably not think yeah. about that, and that's it's not even something that I want them to think about necessarily, but all those things go into the yeah. into the pot.
I was gonna yeah, yeah I was gonna ask actually for an album. We've possibly struggled with this in the past, writing albums ourselves.
You talk about the time I did that Dead or Alive thing.
What's that?
In Waterslide. Is that what you're about to say?
No, that was fantastic, mate. Oh, no, was it? Right.
Nothing wrong with that.
For reference, people, we very, very long time ago, we had a demo of a song called Waterslide. It sounded like Interpol, and then I had my vocal on it sounded like the Dead or Alive. Whoa, 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 whoa.
It came out of nowhere. Oh,
I don't know what was going on there. I didn't even realise I was ripping off Dead or Alive. I'll shut up now.
It was ahead of its time. Like, put it out now. And the top 10 hits will flow.
Yeah.
But yeah, I was going to ask, like, do you have sort of broad strokes ideas when you come to write, well, for example, a Maximum Park album? Do you think this is going to be this album and it's not going to have this and it is going to have that?
Yeah. Absolutely, yeah.
Because I think in the past we've done it and it almost feels like, but again, well, myself, like, hearing ideas that are sort of pop sensibilities but don't necessarily adhere to maybe the broad stroke thing that we said in the first place, but I still really like the hooks in there. So I don't know, are you sort of more focused?
I mean, we try. I mean, we always said, you know, we're never going to write a concept album.
Yeah.
You know, sort of double proggy kind of thing, because it's just not what we're about. I mean, part of me would love to release a double album that is sprawling and you know has lots of different ideas and whatnot on it, but it just doesn't fit with where we are as a band. But yeah, so having said that, we do have a kind of theme that starts to develop in the lyrics, and I'll say to the band, this seems to be what this album's about. When it's time to kind of put the songs together, like on the last album, there was a lot of political reference points and social aspects to the lyrics, and I said, do you feel comfortable with this, to the other guys in the band? Because, you know, ultimately what comes out of my mouth represents them much more than the music does, which is unfortunate in some ways because we are a very democratic band, but you know, people really latch onto the lyrics and themes of records, and it's very hard to talk about music, but it's easy to talk about the theme of a song or the lyrics and quote them in reviews or whatever.
Yeah, well, exactly, yeah.
All of that kind of thing. So it's something that we think about a little bit. And the last album was very unambiguous because it felt like there's a lot of ambiguity and sort of double speak, which we now have, you know, it's formalized into fake news and all that kind of thing. You know, there are more terms to talk about it. You know, that song What Equals Love, for example, was, you know, about that kind of thing, the idea of lying being a good seen as a good thing when somebody does it and go, well, I got away with it, and that person's supporters would be glorifying the fact that they could get away with it. It makes them smart and that kind of thing. And
you talk about Trump's tax return.
Exactly. And
when he came out and said that.
Yeah, and he said,
if I don't pay tax,
guy.
It makes me smart. He actually said
exactly.
that.
And so that was exactly what I was trying to talk about in that song. And I feel like, okay, that's done now. So the next record that we make is probably, I mean, I became a father just over 3 years ago.
Oh.
And that has clearly changed my view on life in some ways, and that I've experienced different things. And I think you don't want to, you know, again, you don't want to be like, right, this is all about being a dad, because it isn't.
Yeah.
But that's going to be one of the themes of the record. And the other guys, and you know, Tom and Dunk, the other two remaining members of Maximo Park, and Lucas, who just left, we're all parents. And so again, I don't feel like I'm misrepresenting anybody, again, until they say, "Oh, I don't think that's a good idea." Like on the last album, there was a song that mentioned the Boys in Blue, which was about the Tory party, and obviously I knew it was also a sort of, you clearly could be referencing the police.
Yeah.
And so the guy said, I think we should take that out, which I was happy to. And I was like, okay. And I kind of we had a debate about it and said, you know, I think people will understand what this song's about. Yeah. The song was called Work and Then Wait, which again was about demonizing people who were on benefits and that kind of thing. But again, hopefully those things are, it's still implied within the songs, but it was very unambiguous. And so I want the new album to be more ambiguous again.
Yeah.
And I think that's we've done it now.
Yeah.
And it feels like with every record, like with Too Much Information, you know, it was like a bit more electronic and it was all over the place. And, you know, we wanted it to be like a mixtape where it goes from, you know, Brain Cells, which is, I guess, influenced more like by sort of warp kind of dance music, to Leave This Island, which is total synth pop, steady sort of synth pop thing. And then you've got Her Name Was Audrey, about Audre Lorde, the poet, and it's a punk rock song, you know, in and out in 2 minutes. And then, right, we make a really cohesive sort of, we've never really allowed the funky and soul, more soulful influences out there. We've never recorded fully live. Yeah. And so with each record, you have these little things. We actually had a whiteboard for the last record for the first time. Sixth album, the whiteboard came out.
It took that long to get.
Oh, and we love a whiteboard.
In the
we
studio.
We used to have a seal of approval, remember?
You've got the seal of approval.
We used to have to draw a seal at the very end of the whiteboard thing for each song.
In the studio, we've had whiteboards to see where we're at.
Oh yeah,
non-conceptual ones. Again, I mean, the first three records are kind of like a trilogy of the same sort of themes, really, of you know, and especially that kind of idea of being in your sort of early 20s through to when you're around 30, all of those kind of things about nightlife and escapism and wondering who you're going to be, what you're going to be.
I mean, talking about sort of being characterized by lyrics on an album campaign, the last album we did was seemingly everywhere we went, people would speak about low-era David Bowie and fried chicken.
Yeah.
Which I think were like two references that we gave to whoever was writing the press release. It was like, it's not an album about fried chicken.
In the words of Danny Dyer, it still freaks my nut out that when we had the first radio play for Big Balloon, which was the single Big Balloon, it was Lauren Laverne. I turned on the radio because I was like, all right, hold on. Probably hungover. Turned the radio on and then she was like, yeah, that's Big Balloon. And the album Big Balloon is coming out. Apparently it's got songs about fried chicken. I was like, oh, God, why did I write that? Why did I throw that false flag in? Really shouldn't have done
that. Have you heard Queen's One Vision where he says fried chicken at the end?
Yeah. Yeah, he says.
I think I have heard that.
Absolutely brilliant.
Give me fried chicken.
Fried chicken.
Do, yeah.
Yeah, that does ring a bell.
Right at the end.
Although I'm strictly a greatest hits volume one kind of chap.
They opened up.
I think volume
two
and
one
three.
Vision,
I think it's just cheating the system there.
It's a cracker.
Yeah.
So this is going to be the last podcast we do of not only of the year but of the decade. I suppose my questions to you are, what's been your favourite release this year? And what release would you say has characterised the decade for you?
Ooh. That is the hardest question I've been asked in a while. But that's because nobody's really asked me any questions in a while.
Okay.
Well, absolutely no press on me solo tour. but yeah, it's very hard to kind of characterize this decade, I think. Yeah. And I think people will find that maybe.
Yeah.
It feels like it's been... I feel like the information that we're bombarded with every day.
Yeah.
I mean, my own brain is kind of scrambled.
Yeah.
And there will be songs on the new Max Seymour Park record, hopefully next year, which engage with the idea of just, you know, being...
Never finishing a sentence.
Yeah, exactly. There you go. You've just done it to me again.
Yeah. just to make it worse, I interrupted you on that, yeah.
There it is. But yeah, everything... I have no idea what's going on, you know. I mean, people will talk about kind of populism in terms of a sort of broader social sweep. But yeah, to me, there's with stuff like Spotify becoming just an everyday thing rather than, you know, a sort of, online streaming, that's the new thing. Yeah. That's just the thing now. And people are into all sorts of different things. And I mean, yesterday I was listening to Billie Eilish and I was like, this
good
is,
stuff,
you know, absolutely brilliant pop music.
Yeah,
you know,
it really is.
I'm still on the fence with it
really?
A little bit. I love Bad Guy.
Yeah,
I don't know. It's just like, I love ASMR, which I know sounds a bit freaky to put that out there right now. Wow. And that's what she is. So she's like ASMR pop, isn't she? In a sense, but I just don't know yet. I don't know.
I'm in.
Bury a friend. Bury a Friend, have you heard that single?
I have.
Because I think,
one.
I mean, I've only been aware of her with this new record, but yeah.
Is it that one?
That's the one.
Yeah.
And again, like, to me, I mean, I prefer some of the other songs, maybe, but it reminds me of, weirdly, of Fiona Apple, who I have a soft spot for. Somebody put Fiona Apple on a mixtape for me when I was at art college, and I was like, whoa, this is a bit, you know... In over the top emotionally, but I loved some of the sort of jazz chords and that kind of thing. And on the second record, I think she had Questlove from The Roots playing the drums, and there's like all sorts of interesting mellotron arrangements by John Bryan, the producer. Anyway, I'm going already further than I would have anticipated in this podcast about my penchant for a little bit of Fiona Apple music.
Yeah.
But yeah, the Billie Eilish thing, it was like a kind of keen musical mind, and again, not the obvious choice in some ways, but then much more of a kind of pop sensibility. But that bedroom production as well, kind of with a real sort of
really like
sense of space.
It's the most minimal yet ear-catching thing I've heard in a long time as well. There's just barely anything to it, but what is there is sort of really, really catchy, sort of pure hooks.
Yeah, no, it's great.
Like, not really shrouded in big pop production.
No, I've been, I mean, this, you know, I was thinking, shall I buy the album? And I've already bought some records this week, and I've already placed my order for the Blue Nile reissue.
Ooh.
He's
got the extended. Has it got the extra tracks with the reissue?
I think so.
I Love This Life going to be on the reissue of Walk Across the Rooftops?
Well, I've got that on B side of.
It was the single they first released before signing to Lynn Records, I believe. And you can find it on Discogs for like 50 quid as a 7-inch, but it's like, I don't think I can trust a well played 7-inch for 50 quid.
Absolutely.
Because
it'll
just be, like, the quality won't be there. I've got Tinseltown and the Rain on 7-inch, and I DJ it sometimes at Dulcimer. And it sounds superb. Like the production, like every song will sound like dog shit. Then you put that on and it's just clear as crystal. And
Lynn
I can't
Records.
Believe it.
Yeah.
And I just refuse to believe that something from the... I don't know.
No,
I DJ that record.
Again, I've got the 7-inch. There's like a double 7-inch thing with two that slot in. Is it for that one or is it...
Yeah.
Anyway. But yeah, for me... I've got the other ones on vinyl, apart from Peace at Last, which I've got on cassette.
Really, really weird that you've brought that up. I got a message from Henry yesterday. Henry in the band, our session player. He went to Stretford Mall. There's a record shop there.
Yeah.
They had Walk Across the Rooftops on vinyl, which he bought. They also had Peace at Last on vinyl. £120.
Yep.
I mean, I'd... I'd buy it. But he showed me the picture of it. I was like, what? Yeah, I didn't even realize they even put that out.
Well,
on vinyl.
It's out this week, and they're in short supply. And I've just
really,
I think it was out on Friday, but I wasn't coming in on into town, so I said, can you put it aside for me? £24, a little bit excessive, but that's the way these things are these days.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's the one that I'm missing from the trilogy on of.
There's always the fourth album as well, lest we forget.
This is the thing. Was that ever released on vinyl?
I'm not sure it was. It gets taken down. It gets taken off Spotify quite regularly. I think they don't like it being out.
Well, I bought it on the day it came out from what was one of those low budget high street shops that was in Music Zone.
Take me back, Paul.
Short lived.
Carry
you know,
on.
only a couple of years at the top, and then it all went wrong again. Yep. Spotify, going back to the earlier ramble. But yeah, I was when I got it, I was quite disappointed because it wasn't as good as the previous three records. And then I listened to it recently when my daughter was born, actually, and I'm not ashamed to say it brought me to tears.
Well, we talk
my
about Brunel on
born.
Most episodes now. but it's a really interesting. I think it's a really interesting process with the Brunel, because I think with each album, they kind of like you, the first time you listen to the next Brunel album, if you start at the beginning, you always go, "Oh no, I think that's a bit too much. Like it's a bit, you know, the water's a bit too cold on that." But then eventually, you just get in there, and go, "Oh, it's all right. Oh my god, I'm here."
Oh, yeah.
And then you go like, "I wonder what the third album sounds like." "Oh no, I think that's a bit too much."
The kind of leap into the sort of it was so glossy that some of the songs feel like they're not there. Mm. They're like just little kind of funk things, but was so glossy. And yeah, that's a real sort of you feel like you're missing some of the kind of texture. But then you realise that's the thing, and you get into the sound of that record, and it becomes this thing where you're like, respect you. Again, they've gone talking about it earlier, that kind of broad strokes, going right, that's what this album's going to be like.
And then you
come right round to Paul Buchanan's solo record.
Oh, Madeira,
again,
yeah.
Bit of a heartbreaker.
About this yesterday as well.
Goodness me, it's the bare bones. And again, you there's like a few songs on it that are catchier than the other ones, and the rest is sort of goes by in a bit of a blur. But then if you listen to each one of those songs individually, it's just, you know, they're like mini plays. They're like Raymond Carver short stories. Absolutely pinpoint. And again, you know, somebody else would go, oh, yeah, no, it's kind of a bit bland, or it's kind of a bit universal, that sort of idea of, you know, of people going about their daily lives, which, again, they kind of nailed on, you know, Tinseltown in the Rain. You know, here we are, men and women caught up in this big rhythm. You know, the idea of... I mean, you won't get better than that, alloyed to the music, especially the emotion of the music, that idea of people being connected, humanity being connected as in this one incredible pop song. You know, how many times has somebody said, yes, I love you in a song, but how many people have said, yes, I love you, with that affirmative yes, sung with such passion by Paul Buchanan? It's an outrage.
I've got to be honest, I'm in far too fragile a state right now. And one detail I've noticed about Midair, specifically, like the solo album, because it's such... Again, like as Dave Harper said, he had a review of it where he said it's the closest yet distant whisper you've ever heard in your life, that album. And then you think, wow, this album is so sad, like in a beautiful sense. And then you listen to the instrumentals afterwards, you go, it's even sadder. Like without, like you take away the words and you just listen to the piano on its own, and it becomes even more separate. And oh my god.
Oh my god, I need a hug.
Yeah.
I don't think I can go on. Favorite records. This is the thing, it all pales into insignificance.
One thing we usually do, last thing. Doesn't feel right to do it now, but we'll do it anyway. So a lot of our guests, we ask them if there's a particular embarrassing lowlight in your career.
maybe one that's occurred at the Clooney, as we're at the Clooney. Perhaps something like that.
It could
if
be,
you
it,
need some connection.
I mean, nothing too, like, vicious. But, you know, something like humorously shit.
Oh, God.
I know, it's tough.
It's many in some ways. And then, you know...
Or perhaps one that happened in Germany, perhaps. Maybe not on this tour, but maybe like a previous tour.
I love when I ask this question, I can just see people like reeling off. Like,
yeah.
Just that lifetime, yeah, exactly. That
you just see that flicker of the eyelids. Yeah. It's like, oh no.
when I come onto stage, quite often it's to a very upbeat song of ours, whatever it might be. Girls Who Play Guitars is one that we often open with.
Yeah.
And we've probably, you know, something that's reasonably well known as well, and you want to make a big entrance, yeah, especially if it's your own show. We've done all sorts of different ways of coming on or whatever, but yeah, especially I think this might have been in about 2007-08, something like that. You know, our albums were, you know, even more popular than they are now. that's a funny way of saying it. we were on the telly a little bit more than we are now, obviously.
Yeah.
Again, hugely successful at the moment. still riding the crest of a wave, I would say. around that time, we were on French TV and German TV. I think one of them was Arte in France, which goes over into Germany, and MTV in Germany. We were playing thing called, it was some sort of circus, and there was people with, like, you know, the compere maybe had a lion tamer's outfit on, God knows what was going on, and I ran onto stage both times in some very slippery shoes, and I fell onto me bum quite badly on both of those occasions on the telly. and then sort of,
is this on YouTube anywhere?
I wouldn't like to say. But yeah, there's some sort of circus, it was called, I don't know, and it, yeah, please don't look it up. But it was just, you know, you just, it feels like the wind has been taken out of your sails.
Yeah.
It's like when at school something like that would happen, you'd just be like, yeah, I'm having a laugh with my mates, I'm going to go out, I'm going to make a big entrance, I'm going to be Mr. Showbiz,
yeah,
for like the opening part of this song, get the crowd on side, the spectacle of being on stage. And I just slipped straight on my ass.
Oh shit.
Oh dear. On the telly in front of thousands of people.
Well.
And you know, I kind of sort of tried to backflip my way back up, which is, you know, a bit like Take That back in their heyday.
There's no way back, is
there? There's no way back. There's no way back.
You either just sort of go, whatever you do,
you just gotta get up. You get on the microphone. I did that on purpose.
Shut it.
It's like when you trip over in the street and you look behind you.
Yeah.
A trip over a paving stone. A little glance behind you, yeah, as if to say,
anyone see?
Huh? What's this? What's
you didn't notice that? Did you?
Yeah. Oh my goodness.
But you can't really do that on stage.
But yeah, on stage, there's nowhere to hide. So being a fairly high tempo band and all action frontman, I was like, got back up and just gave it even more. Yeah. Forget this. And the people at home were just rewinding, unfortunately. Anyway, yeah, that's...
Well, that's a classic.
It's miserable.
A classic, yeah, frontman falls over story.
Yeah.
Some of the, yeah.
Reg-cheeked for at least the next three songs.